Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Cynthia Johnson Turner. Turner is a conductor, speaker, and conducting and ensemble clinician in the U.S., Latin America, Europe, and Canada. She is a graduate of both Queen's University and the University of Victoria in Canada. She is currently an associate professor of music and conducting, as well as director of wind ensembles at Cornell University. She has been a guest conductor all over the world, including the Latin America Honor Band, the Paris Lodron Ensemble in Salzburg, and the provincial honor bands of Alberta, Manitoba, and Ontario. In 2006 and 2008, she led the Cornell University Wind Ensemble on performance and service tours of Costa Rica. And welcome to the show.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
It is.
I should be tired by the sound of that.
I want to begin with your beginnings. How did you get involved in music? How did you segue into conducting?
Oh, interesting question. How long do we have?
Long enough.
Music was an early, early love. I can remember asking my parents for a keyboard or piano when I was very, very young. I became a clarinet saxophone player in middle school and high school, and I knew almost immediately that I wanted to teach music because it was so transformative for me. And you mentioned the performing tours and service learning tours. I was a student on those when I was in high school, and they changed my life. And so when I came to Cornell, I knew I wanted to do that.
Wow.
And the transition into conducting, I became a music teacher after a year in Switzerland teaching computers in French and music and choral music and all that sort of stuff. I became a music teacher in Ontario and then became head of a music program at a school outside of Toronto, Parkside High School. 10 years into that, I met my now husband, who was moving out to Victoria to become a vice president of a startup university, and said, come on out. And so I did my master's in music education and conducting and leadership, and that was it. I was hungry for more school. I love school. I'd be in school all the time if I could.
We are all in school
all
the time, many of us who are so curious about
right.
life.
Well, then it was, am I smart enough to do my doctorate? Maybe not. Am I talented enough? Long story short, I apparently was, and was accepted, among other places, at the Eastman School, which blew my mind, actually, because Eastman School I revered and still revere.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now I'm guest conducting there.
Oh, that's so great.
Fall.
It must have opened up such
a
world to you. But you know what I wanted to ask you, Cynthia? Conducting still seems like a male enclave. So was that hard for you to get training and be taken seriously in the early days?
You know, my normal response to this question over the years has been, next question. Music and genitals have nothing to do with each other. But I've changed my mind. Yes.
Makes them differentiate.
It does. Mm. And I have never experienced any overt discrimination in this country or in Canada.
Huh.
I have experienced, shall we say, covert discrimination or just things you just can't quite put your finger on.
Yeah, like passive-aggressive behaviors.
Yeah, in Europe, in Latin America, to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And the more reading I do about it now, it's like the bra burning never actually happened. There's some very interesting articles on the internet right now. Marin Alsep is talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
I think I will not name him, but a young conductor who's seen as an up-and-coming superstar, male, was quoted as saying, the cuter a female conductor is, the more the musicians don't think about music. Something to that extent.
Oh,
just
absolutely, I'm
just
sure.
Kind of a Neanderthal for thinking it and politically inept for saying it out loud.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a real career winner for him. But it sparked all sorts of discussion about this. And, conductors and female composers have experienced, it's never overt.
It's not overt.
And the more enlightened we are,
it's
like racism. The more enlightened we are, I'm not a racist. And yet we do have biases.
Yeah.
We do have stereotypes.
We live in a culture where it permeates subliminally sometimes.
Right.
And we're not even aware of it.
Right.
But let's go back to conducting, though.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think a good conductor needs to be versed in all the various forms of music? Classical, I know you've gotten into new music,
mm-hmm.
experimental music.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that makes you a better conductor?
I think just about any experience makes one a better person, and therefore, in my case, a better conductor.
Mm.
Do I think I need to know lots of forms of music? Absolutely, because they all inform the other. I've learned so much watching choral conductors and working with choral conductors. Mm-hmm. The intimacy of the voice versus the interruption of an instrument between the body and the audience. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot listening to pop music, really good pop music, and what turns on an audience. And why? Why is that so accessible? And what can we be doing in the classical world to kind of tap into that and still maintain our integrity? Yeah. As artists. Yeah, I think really being versed in all musics and musicking, if I can say that kind of trendy word, is important.
Yeah.
Really
yeah.
important.
You know, I have a lot of friends who ask me to ask you about this. They're fans of classical music, traditional classical music, but they cannot wrap their ear around the dissonant, strange, chaotic music of some new music, like the Kronos Quartet, perhaps, is an example. How do you teach people to love that kind of music? Do we need to re-educate?
Great question. There's sort of two streams going on, maybe three, where, in my view, a lot of so-called accessible music, pop music, is becoming quite silly. and in the classical world, we had a period in our history, when I say our history, I mean classical, quote-unquote, legitimate, high art, highbrow music, mm-hmm. that was also silly, in my opinion. The 12-tone, I'm going to step on toes here, but there was a period where, quote-unquote, experimental high art music was completely ununderstandable to most people, uh-huh. including musicians. And I'll admit that I have my lowbrow moments, and I'm okay with that. If I'll be sitting in a classical music concert and I'll hear a piece and I'll just think to myself, I don't get that. I need to go look at the score. I need to listen to that 100 times to understand why people think that that was really interesting and important for me to know. But we're busy. So for the quote-unquote average listener, it's hard on first listening to understand that. And you know, we have this myth that the famous composers during their day were not understood. And maybe some of them, but most of them were. Most of them had wonderful lives and were applauded and lauded mm-hmm. in their time. So to me, what's interesting is to find that living classical composer who's either walking the balance beam between quote-unquote accessibility or speaking to the quote-unquote average listener in an interesting way and yet is remaining true to his or her artistic vision. That's we could go on for hours about this. You know, do we care if they're listening?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if an audience member falls asleep in the concert hall, did the concert happen? You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
if a tree
yeah.
falls in the forest, we could just go on.
That's right. That's
go
right.
on and on.
But I want to play an excerpt from a Cornell Wind Ensemble concert that you did. The album, it comes from a CD called Augenblink. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
This
Blink
is
of an eye.
Ah, yes. This is called Exorcism by Ryan Gallagher. You want to tell us a bit about it, and then we'll hear an excerpt from it.
Sure. Ryan has graduated since from Cornell, wonderful composer, as is his father, Jack Gallagher. Ryan is interested in exactly the thing we're talking about, this kind of intersection between so-called pop music or accessible music and classical music. So a lot of his music incorporates electric guitar. We did a piece with Festival Chamber Orchestra, which I share with Chris Kim at Cornell, that was for him on electric guitar and chamber orchestra. This piece is for death metal drummer, and death metal music, as I understand it, is much more, shall we say, intense than metal music. It's uh-huh. got this, you will hear underlining, incredibly hard driving beat that is pure energy.
Yeah, let's listen to an excerpt from it.
Thank you.
You know, I found that such a complicated piece in many ways, and I just wondered how you as a conductor kept it all together. it seemed so complicated to me.
Yeah, it was. So when we did the performance, Derek Roddy is a fabulous, one of the most interesting soloists I've ever worked with. Not a diva bone in his body.
Ah.
Thrilled to be at Cornell, hair down to his knees, humble, and yet he was doing more with his left foot on the bass drum than I could do with my right hand, which is my strong hand. I mean, just unbelievable player. And he was so good that he kept us together.
Ah, so you didn't really have to do that much? Perhaps?
Right. Conductor's done. There you go. We've nailed it.
And so the drummer's good, right?
Well, I mean, you've actually hit on an interesting point. The better the ensemble, the less a conductor should do or have to do, right? The more a conductor should just get out of the way.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to my next question, though. Well, what are the duties of a conductor in your estimation and in your experience?
Facilitator. The better the musician, the more intelligent the musician, and we have very intelligent musicians at Cornell.
Mm.
The more I see, there's a famous quote about leadership, great leadership is when the followers say we did it ourselves. And to me, that's a great conductor. When the orchestra or the wind ensemble or the band or the choir or whatever says, we did that. And that to me is, yeah, okay, that was a success.
And do you have to understand all the music? I mean, do you feel like you have to have a really intimate understanding?
Yes.
And does that take a long time to develop and absorb?
Yes, I spend an incredible amount of time studying scores. I think that's my duty. I think that's a way I respect the time and effort that a composer has put into a piece.
Mm-hmm.
I sing every line. As soon as I make a mistake, whether it's rhythmic or pitch, I mark it because that will save time in rehearsal. If I made the mistake, then maybe that violinist will make that mistake, and I can catch it quickly. By reading every line, I know when to cue somebody. Because, gosh, the trumpets haven't played for 65 bars. Maybe they wouldn't mind a little gift of a cue here. Things like that, and that helps me. You know, it's a bit like peeling an onion, a score. It's an overview, and then you get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And the more important the music, the better the music, the deeper the music, the bigger that onion is. You're just never finished.
Uh-huh. And do you work really intimately with the composer, too, and sometimes find out that you're doing it wrong, and the composer comes in and says, no, Cynthia, you've got the horns all wrong. There's too much, you know.
It's hard to work closely with Beethoven or something like that, which is maybe a good thing.
I'm thinking of the new music that you're involved in.
Yeah, I love working with the new composers. No, thankfully, if I could knock wood, I'll tap on my own head. No composer has put their hands up in the air and said, you idiot, what are you doing? Thank goodness. And I think that's because I study it so much. But I love that immediate interaction with a living composer.
Uh-huh,
I mean,
uh-huh.
It just doesn't get any better. I always encourage composers who've written a piece not to come to the first rehearsal. That's just not going to be fun for anybody. You know, they get scared, we get intimidated, all that sort of stuff. It's third or fourth rehearsal, when we think we're finessing it, we're at that stage, and the composer comes in and says, you know what I was thinking here? And we go, gosh, that just makes it all, that makes sense.
Ah.
Gosh, we'll try it this way.
Ah. Now, you teach conducting and performance.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us how you approach that. I mean, it feels like conductors are always very dramatic. is that part of the training, or is that people's personalities?
I think it should be. Nobody's written that article yet, as far as I'm concerned, that personality matters on the podium.
Oh, I'm sure.
Technique is important. Study is important. Education is important. Personality is often more important.
Mm.
How you engage with people, how you respect people, if you're funny, if you're relaxed, if you are, inviting as a person. Yeah, you've got to know your stuff, of course, but these are people that you're working with, and you're in it together.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cynthia Johnson-Turner. She's a conductor and professor at Cornell University. Now, I want to play another excerpt from Augenblick, and this one's called Out Loud, and it's by Catherine Licuta.
Licuta.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to focus on this a little bit to talk about women composers.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about the piece first.
Kathy is an extremely talented composer. Her background is in jazz piano, so she's also a fabulous player. This piece I asked her to write features her on jazz piano and wind ensemble. And it's, interestingly, it's a very, I don't want to say aggressive, but if I had to say a word, and I really hesitate saying this, it's a masculine piece of music. It's and her playing, you'll hear is, or I don't know if we'll get to that excerpt, but her playing is, she's very strong on the piano, and her music has this driving energy as well that, that, you know, it just suggests anti-Debussy. Let me put it that way.
Let's listen to it. It's called Out Loud. I found that piece really, really fascinating. And I am fascinated by the fact that there still aren't that many women composers, at least not that I have heard of.
Like conductors, we're certainly in the minority. But I just read an article, whether I believe it or not, that the third largest growing industry or job in America is composing, which is fascinating to me. Kristen Custer, I hope I'm saying that right, at the University of Michigan wrote an article, something like, I'm going to take my pants off now, talking about women composers and how she and I think, had the same philosophy. If I ignore this problem, you know, next question, please, what's it like to be a woman and a composer? What's it like to be a woman and conductor? The problem will go away. Well, lo and behold, the problem isn't going away.
Yeah, yeah.
And she wrote a very fascinating article on that.
The follow-up to that, I mean, we don't see that many women composers.
Right, it still seems
to be a hard place for women to find, you know, a home. And I was just wondering, does that have to do with the conductors and the people who are calling for new music? Are they ignoring some of the women composers out there?
Well, I'm not. And the folks over at Ithaca College aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And we aren't at Cornell. I think that, like a lot of, let's for instance, the science and technology industry, there, you know, NPR did a fascinating story on this. Why aren't there more women in science and technology?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, after, you know, expensive research, that the answer is because there's not a lot of women in science and technology, meaning that it's a vicious circle and there aren't any role models.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a slow change.
Mm-hmm.
And it is changing, but it's like any kind of evolution. Sometimes we don't notice it as it's happening.
Yeah, I know. So being aware of it is going to be one of the first steps, I assume.
Right.
Now, let's talk about new technology. You are one of the first people to use Google Glass as a conductor. Tell us how this is changing the whole paradigm of teaching and conducting.
Right. Google Glass is the newest technology that we know about from Google, which is basically a wearable computer. Vogue did a 6 or 7 page spread in their September issue of lots of skinny women wearing Google Glass, which to me means it's been accepted visually, even though I still think I look like a cyborg when I put it on. Well, I sort of won a Twitter contest with it. If I had glass, I would. And hashtag if I had glass, I said I would use it in the conducting lab to videotape students and give them immediate feedback. I would use it to live stream concerts so an audience can see what the conductor sees during a performance.
That would be fascinating.
Well, you'll need to come to the concert on September 29th because we're going to demo that to the audience, and then we're going to have them do a poll on their cell phones. Do you think that this will be interesting? Are you neutral, or will you find it annoying because there's a lag? With any kind of video feed, there's a slight lag. So what they're going to be seeing in real time, the back of me on the podium, and what they're going to be seeing visually on the screen will be slightly different.
Ah.
And so far, the input is some people think, no, I think it's going to be really, I think you should do it. It's going to be really interesting. Other people, I don't really know. And other people going, gosh, I think that's going to drive me crazy.
Yeah.
In the conducting lab, I used it yesterday for the first time, and I liked it. I'm seeing you nodding, and this is one of the pitfalls of Google Glass, because if a young conductor or student conductor is doing something that I really think's hip or it's I like it, it's an improvement, I'm doing exactly what you're doing right now, and I'm nodding, and guess what? Their video looks like the Blair Witch Project.
You described it as the Blair Witch Project. It'll make people seasick.
Yeah, exactly. So I have to, quote-unquote, curb my enthusiasm and just sort of, you know, yes, that sounds good. The other downfall is that my voice is the loudest on their video. But the upsides are so wonderful. Yesterday I had the experience, and therefore the student did, moments later, when I could approach the student who was showing tension in his shoulder. Every time he gave a downbeat, his shoulder came up, and therefore there was tension in his shoulder. I was able to go up to him, put both hands on either side of his shoulder, and while he was still conducting, I said, keep going, and bring his shoulder down. And so he saw on his video almost immediately later.
Oh, so this could be immediate teaching.
Almost immediate. And so he was able to see my hands on his shoulder. He was able to see the tension release. And he was able to see exactly what he was doing wrong and how he could fix it.
Wow. It seems this would have all kinds of implications in medical world and all kinds of worlds.
A surgeon just live streamed a surgery.
Wow.
So anything where you need both hands. Imagine, medical school, EMS. You know, they can video feedback to the emergency room. Imagine chef school. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's just
conductors.
The conductor
doing that is so fascinating to me.
So I think it's all going to depend on the software.
Yeah.
How easy it is to develop the applications. The iPhone's only 5 years old, and I remember when it came out, and there were a couple of people that had it, and I thought, oh boy, look at me. When you're talking, look at me. And now,
you just have to wait and see how the human is going to become sucked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to play a piece that I actually really love this piece, and this is another one that you conducted. It's called Platter of Discontent, mm-hmm. and it's by Mark Melitz. Tell us a little bit about it. I love this piece.
This is another composer who rides the line between accessibility and art, high art, in a very creative, exciting way. This piece speaks to a lot of people. You're not the only one that sort of hears this piece and goes, wow, that is really cool. His writing for piano and marimba in particular, and also violin. Christine, his wife, plays violin on this album.
Mm.
Beautiful player. He just writes in such a way that's just kind of melt in your mouth. It's just lovely.
It's close like your a summer breeze or some kind of
gorgeous stuff.
Yeah, let's listen to a bit of this. It's a gorgeous piece. Mm-hmm. I just love it.
He's such a cool guy. The way his brain works, to me, is really fascinating. He wrote a piece for us subsequently called Requiem for a Hummingbird, which is a 3-minute piece for wind ensemble. And he was inspired by a hummingbird that he saw resting, which is something we don't see often.
No, you don't.
And he had this whole story in his head that if it was resting, it meant that, you know, because basically hummingbirds go from one sugar high to the next,
right.
You know. Uh-huh. And he had this idea that that hummingbird was mourning the loss of his mate because it didn't get a sugar high. And so it's got this kind of, you know, side story and this nature thing, and it's just a beautiful little piece.
Oh, I love that kind of innovation.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
really interesting. You know, well, we're almost out of time. I just want to ask you really briefly, how has music enchanted your life, and what would your life be without it?
Mm. I don't want to think about that question. It would be
empty of almost everything, I would assume. Look at your face; just shows that.
Yeah, that's a hard one to think.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any upcoming concerts you want to tell us about? Contact information.
Yes, the www.cuwinds.com. If you want to read the blog about our research with glass, how it's changing the scene of conducting and performance. How people react to it, how we've experienced it at Cornell. Tyler Ehrlich is a student conductor who's working with it as well. Barb mm-hmm. Friedman in Academic Technologies is helping us with the research. We have a concert on September 29th where we will introduce the glass. Then in November, we have another concert where we will actually project the image and use glass in a concert and get the audience reaction. We have our fifth upcoming service learning and performance tour to Panama and Costa Rica, where we donate instruments and perform around the country and teach young children and talk about music changing lives.
Great. Well, Cynthia Johnson-Turner, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.